You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, a look at communication in animals and what it can tell us about the evolution of language in people. Just about anyone who has a pet will tell you, you know, no doubt, and there is no doubt, that animals can communicate, right? Your dog, your cat, they communicate with each other. Your dog might understand ball or biscuit, can let you know when it's time to go out, or let you or the cat know that that red chair by the fireplace, get out, that's my spot. You don't sit there. And think about the last time you went to the zoo. Like me, you probably stopped at the monkey house, right, or at the chimpanzee cages. You watch them play with each other or entertain the crowd. There's no doubt that the monkeys, the chimps, the apes have their own forms of communication, right? You watch it, but how does it work? Are those grunts and squeals, are they like our words and phrases? Will a monkey make sure another monkey understands what's being said when you shout at somebody and they don't listen to you? You keep shouting over and over again. Will a monkey or an ape do that? We'll talk about that. Do apes have their own language? What is the language? What is it? What is that language, for that matter? And if animals communicate so differently from us, can we really learn anything useful about the way we communicate by studying them? If they're so different, what can we learn? We're going to talk about this for the rest of the hour. Communication in our nearest relatives, the non-human primates, including apes and monkeys. So I'm not going to really talk about your dogs and cats. So we'll try not to stay talking about and the primates, apes, monkeys, people. And what do scientists know about how these animals talk to each other? You know, we've seen stories in the news the past decades about apes talking to one another. Are they really talking in the same depth of speech that we do? And what can they tell us about the language and people? Let me introduce my guests. Barbara J. King is professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia. She's also a member of the organizing committee of the Council for Human Development and co-editor of The Origins of Language, What Non-Human Primates Can Tell You, published by the School of American Research Press. She joins us today from Colonial Williamsburg. Thanks for being with us, Dr. King.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
My wife's favorite place she's never been to. Colonial Williamsburg. She wants to go down there. Something awful. Dorothy Cheney is a professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and she joins us from the studios of WHHY in Philly. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Cheney.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Mark Hauser is a professor of psychology and the director of the Mind-Brain Behavior Program at Harvard. He's also the author of several books, including Wild Minds, What Animals Really Think, published by Henry Holt, and The Evolution of Communication, published by MIT Press. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Hauser.
Thank you very much.
I read, Dr. King, that if you try to define what language is, you could spend days doing that.
Yes. One thing that a group of us agreed when we had a 5-day seminar on this topic was that we couldn't define what language really is. I have a view of language that I think is probably not the most conventional and the most dominant one. Traditionally, it's thought that if animal A is communicating with animal B, the important process is transmitting signals between them. So on this view, what becomes very interesting are the vocalizations or the gestures or their properties. And that's not how I look at language and primate communication.
How do you look at it?
Well, when I study apes, most recently gorillas and bonobos, my unit of analysis has not been a word or a vocalization or a gesture, but rather what happens when the apes together socially construct meaning. In other words, what happens when they groom or play or mate or have mothers and infants interacting, and they move their arms, legs, and bodies together, they make facial expressions, they make certain utterances. My hypothesis that I've been testing for 5 years now is that they together, in some cases, converge on some type of meaning that's a much more nuanced process than simply an exchange of signals.
Does that mean that each group of primates has their own vocabulary because it evolved differently from another group?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I don't think we have a very good answer to that yet. I'm not suggesting that each pair of animals builds up some kind of idiosyncratic vocabulary. There can be a stable core with a movement that gets translated in a certain way, but it's very much modified by facial expression, by what's happening in the social system around the two communicators. Now, when you look across groups, It does seem, if you compare groups of the same species, that there are different built-up communication repertoires, if you will. But we're really just at the start of beginning to understand that.
Dorothy Cheney, do you agree with this definition of language communication?
Well, you can have, you know, a language probably has as many definitions as there are people who've tried to think about definitions. And, of course, a lot of it will depend on the sorts of questions that you're trying to address. And so I think it's not at all controversial to state that many animal species, if not all animal species, communicate with one another, with members of their own species in some way. The question that many people are interested in what ways are their systems of communication different from those of humans, and specifically human language. When you think about it in those terms, it becomes very useful to look at how animals communicate with each other, but it's also very useful to examine perhaps what they're not doing when they communicate with each other.
Do they have more similarities than differences with us?
Well, Darwin, I think, expressed it very well. I think he was one of the first, well, undoubtedly he wasn't the first, but certainly one of the first to articulate it explicitly. He said that animals like dogs, getting back to dogs, have general concepts of things like cats or sheep, and he said that they know these corresponding words, and they can learn corresponding words for concepts as well as any human philosopher. And he regarded this as half the language question. The question then becomes, in my mind, why don't animals, dogs, monkeys, chimps, articulate all these concepts? Why does their knowledge essentially remain non-explicit and is not shared? In marked contrast, for example, to very young children who have an annoying but endearing way of just announcing everything about the world that they know at a very young age.
And did you reach any conclusion about that? Why don't they share their knowledge?
Well, one hypothesis that's not unique to us is that what they lack is the ability to attribute mental states to others, the ability to recognize that not everyone in the world shares their own knowledge, beliefs, and so on. So they may not recognize, perhaps, when something needs to be articulated in the same way that even a very young child does.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, if you'd like to talk about communication. Mark Hauser, where do you come down on this?
I guess I'd lean towards what Dorothy described a little more. And in part, I think it's because I think, at least I would like to make a distinction between language in the way that linguists dating back at least into Noam Chomsky's period of the 50s and communication. And so I guess the sort of side I want to fall on is that there are certain kinds of abilities that the minds of humans and other animals have that may or may not be used in the service of communication, or maybe they will. So Chomsky at least makes a distinction between the kinds of abilities that are kind of internal to the mind and what that brings us in terms of thinking about the world, and then distinguishing that between how we may use those abilities to communicate about the world. So I think it's important to make those distinctions between a lot of the things that go on inside our mind we actually don't even communicate about at all. So I think, you know, the sense in which Dorothy just talked about the fact that you have animals often sort of humming around the world with rich conceptual views of the world, and they may or may not be able to communicate about those, I think is an extremely interesting, you know, paradox. Because for us, simply because we understand that there is an arbitrary association between sound and meaning, we can clearly create any kind of word because that relationship is completely arbitrary. So it's that capacity, in some sense, which animals may just not have. And therefore, you know, the sort of one kind of analogy is they're sort of stuck, like Franz Kafka's character Gregor Samsa in The Metamorphosis, you know, stuck inside a body with rich thoughts and without the ability to communicate about those.
Can we ever find out if they are stuck there?
Well, I mean, I think the kinds of work that you know, the sort of the three of us and many other people as well have been doing over the past, you know, many years are beginning to make headways on both the extent to which they can communicate about certain things in a kind of rich way, and also the constraints on those. And I think, I guess where I would fall is that, at least the current state of knowledge, is that the system for conveying the richness of their internal lives is remarkably impoverished relative to the capacity that we have to convey the richness of our lives.
Let's talk about your paper in this week's Science, where you looked at tamarin monkeys and their ability to understand a certain type of grammar. Tell us what you were trying to find out with that experiment.
Well, I think there were sort of two goals with this experiment, and one was that much of the work that had focused on the capacity of animals to have grammar or rule-like structures which allow them to string together either sounds or their natural vocalizations that have meaning and to create new meaning, or in the case of the sort of ape language studies, to combine signs that had been taught to them to create new meaning. Those have largely failed in terms of the capacity to produce grammatical strings. And so the question that we really wanted to address was a question about their competence or their perception. So in other words, having been exposed to a set of examples that seem to fit a rule, can they derive what the rule is? And so the foundation for the work was really to take what's often been called in linguistics the Chomskyan hierarchy, which is a way of thinking about the complexity of different kinds of rules, and is to build different rules that have different kinds of complexity and to ask the monkeys whether they would have the ability to extract what those rules are. So this is not about production. Mm-hmm. This is more about perception.
Mm-hmm. The attributes that we attribute to your famous gorillas like Coco and whatever, being able to communicate with people and seem to synthesize ideas, has that been discounted these days?
Well, probably like language, it probably depends on who you on who you ask. I guess I have, you know, I think one view of it, and I think it's sort of simply this. I think those studies have shown a number of quite remarkable abilities in these apes, and so they certainly show, for example, that the apes that have been used in these studies can acquire something like 300 to 400 different signs that seem to pick out certain things in their world. The reason why I think I want to sort of temper how we interpret that is because if you take even the most generous view of the number of symbols they've acquired and the extent to which they use those to communicate, it really pales next to the average high school graduate who might know 60,000 words. And I think when you get that sort of inequity in the numbers, you really have to ask the question, is the mechanism underlying the way in which these apes use those signs the same as that in which we use signs, either sign language or in the case of our words? And my conclusion, at least, is that the mechanism is really completely different.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy Cheney, are they just being trained, or do they have any?
Well, I think, again, some of these attempts to teach a human form of communication to these animals is actually allowing them to perhaps make explicit some of the concepts that they already have. But I think it's also important, and I think Mark sort of touched on this, is that when you take a gorilla like Coco, and again, this is horribly contentious, and I'm sure people would disagree with me, I don't think people have really demonstrated that in any of the ape language projects very convincingly that these animals have a greater capacity to learn to associate sounds with objects than, say, a dog or a sea lion or a parrot or a dolphin. And so I think one of the other questions that we have to ask is, what is it, if anything, that makes the primate brain, in this case the ape's brain, but also the monkey's brain, different from the average mammalian brain or even an avian brain?
Excuse me for calling you Barbara, Dorothy. I'll talk to
Oh, sorry.
Barbara King?
Maybe I just interrupted.
No, it's okay. That was my mistake. I do it every week, so I'm at least consistent. Barbara King, where do you come down on this?
Well, I agree very much with the point that both Mark and Dorothy have made, that we need to preserve a distinction between language and communication. When I say that I look at language a certain way, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that I'm suggesting that the apes themselves that I have studied have language. I do think, though, that the starting point to defining language is going to really derive the way we test our non-human primate subjects and look at them. And I think that if we look at the spontaneous behavior of particularly the great apes, the chimpanzees, the bonobos, and the gorillas, what we see are not animals that are trapped in their minds and bodies and unable to share their knowledge. They simply don't share it with exactly the same mechanisms that humans use when they communicate. In other words, they are able very much to approach each other and intentionally together converge on a negotiated meaning that we can see if we have methods that are sensitive enough to get away from looking only at things like grammar and words. I think that work is extremely valuable, but that we miss a certain dimension of non-human primate communication if we don't broaden it and look at what happens in the social event.
Mm-hmm. Talking about communications this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, if the apes communicate so much at such a cruder level than we do as humans, can we learn anything about our own communication from studying them? Or is it just like trying to look at a two-year-old child and trying to learn from that? Dr. King?
I do think that it's very important for anthropologists to study the differences as well as the similarities. In that way, I also agree with Mark and Dorothy. What I would prefer to do is to suggest that by studying the great apes, we can really get a good handle on how to understand the evolutionary starting point for language, rather than so much understanding our language and recalibrating that starting point, if you will. I mean, we have to accept that we don't have any great apes from 6 or 7 million years ago, you know, to study their behavior. We have to study what we can see now. And yet we can understand what it was in place in terms of this social process before the hominids began to evolve. The other thing we can do is to really focus on those differences. For example, great apes, I believe, don't get very interested in simply showing each other objects or making declarative statements about the world or talking about the past or the future. And in that way, we really differ very much.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Toby in Boise. Hi, Toby.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Fine.
Good. I had a question for everybody here. Thanks for taking my call, by the way. I've thought about this quite a bit. I'm actually a sociology teacher in a high school, and we talk a lot about whether or not animals communicate, believe it or not, in sociology. But ultimately, my question would be this. How do we resolve the idea of looking at animals from a speciocentric, if you will, perception, meaning that animals obviously communicate, I believe, but we do so, all creatures do so, based on sensory perception. And if our sensory perception varies from species to species, when we view, say, communications between dolphins, we're viewing a very, very limited piece of the pie.
Yeah, we can't really get inside their brains to see what's going
right.
on.
Right. So how do people who study it resolve that major question there?
Dr. Cheney, want to take a bite at that?
That's a very good point. And I think as a result, it makes it very difficult actually to sort of look at the world from the perspective, say, of a dog whose olfactory system is so much better than ours.
Mm-hmm.
One of the lucky things about monkeys and apes is that their perceptual abilities are rather similar to ours. I mean, that we know that they hear pretty much what we can hear. Their olfactory abilities are not much better than ours, and their visual acuity is basically like us. So we can make some assumptions that their world looks and sounds more or less like our world looks and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing one has to do, and I think all three of us have taken this approach, is to look at animal communication on its own terms. And so, for example, Robert Seifert and I have spent most of our careers, all of our careers really, studying monkeys in the wild because we want to see how they communicate and what they communicate about and what they don't communicate about in the absence of human training.
Dr. Cheney, hold on there because I have to communicate. We have to take a break. So
okay, sorry.
That's the way I have to do it, so I'm sorry. I'll make a noise. Stay with us. We're going to be right back and talk more about communication, so don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. The next Talk of the Nation on Monday, join host Neil Conan for Who Owns This Issue? Part 2. The issue this time, the politics of race. That's on Monday's Talk of the Nation. This hour, we're talking about animal communications with my guests, Barbara King, professor of anthropology at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Dorothy Cheney, professor of biology at the University of Pennsylvania, Mark Hauser, professor of psychology and director of the Mind, Brain, and Behavior Program at Harvard University. Our number 1-800-989-8255. And when I rudely interrupted Dr. Cheney, she was telling us about how she studies animals and whether you can actually get inside the head of a chimpanzee to study it. Go ahead. You want to finish your thought, Dr. Cheney?
My thoughts are just too dispersed.
Okay, let me ask you another question if you'd like. Go ahead. Tell us about why you study monkeys out
monkeys,
in the wild.
I'd love to be studying
money.
Obviously, monkeys are not as closely related to us as humans are, as chimps are, rather. But they are easier to study and logistically. And they also live in very large groups, and they have very complex social groups. And so you can go out and actually, we study baboons in Botswana. And we're studying animals that live in groups of 75 or 80, where the social networks are extensive. The animals know huge amounts about not only their own social relationships and their own dominance ranks, but also the dominance ranks and social relationships of others. They're very aware of this, a very vast and complex network of alliances, retribution, enemies, friends, and so on. And so you can look at communication and behavior in a context that we can hypothesize was rather similar to a social group that was may have been representative of the way our early human ancestors lived.
Tell us about the vervet monkeys that you studied.
Well, we studied, for a long time, we studied vervet monkeys in Kenya. And the one of the motivations for studying them is that they have a quite elaborate alarm call system, which we now know is not unique to them, where they seem to be able to designate predators with acoustically different calls. So we call those referentially, functionally referential, in the sense that if you or I are out there and we know their system of communication, and we hear a particular call type, we know that it refers to the presence of a leopard or the presence of an eagle. And so in that sense, these animals have calls that at least function somewhat like words, but at the same time, they're also very different from words. For example, there's no evidence that these monkeys learn the association. I mean, they can learn the association between a call and a particular type of predator, but throughout Africa, the animals, vervet monkeys, will give the same sounding call to a leopard. So you don't have languages and dialects in the way that humans have. The other thing is, as has been mentioned already, is that you lack syntax. So if I'm a monkey and I hear another individual give a leopard alarm call, I know a leopard is nearby, but it doesn't really help me that much because I don't know where the leopard is, how far away it is, whether it's to my left, to my right, whether it's behind me. Whereas syntax could do that for you. You know, syntax with the use of a preposition, you could say in a bush or up in the tree. These animals don't do that. And as Barbara has already mentioned, they don't comment on things. So you don't talk about things in their absence. You don't say, you know, for example, that nasty old flea bag that ate my mother last month. It's simply leopard here now.
Yeah. Do the higher apes, the apes that are more closer to humans, do they put syntax into it and give you a little bit of a hint of where to look or get out of the way?
Well, people know virtually nothing about the communication of chimps under natural conditions, although very recently there's been some work done in the Thai forest and the Ivory Coast, the same place where Ebola has been documented among these chimps, that suggests that chimps, in at least some context, combine sounds and combine displays like drumming to refer to completely different objects. So, for example, they have a particular bark that they give to snake. But when the snake bark is combined with drumming, it signifies neighboring group. That's not really syntax, but it does suggest the ability to perhaps combine signs to designate completely different objects in the world.
Right. Are these monkeys, and I'll ask all of you, and the apes that you study, are they being altruistic? I mean, are they working for the good of the whole clan when they see an eagle overhead or something like that, and they give a warning a leopard is coming? Or are they basically doing this out of fear? Dorothy, you want to begin with that? Do they know if anybody hears them? If they're making a wild call.
There certainly seems to be a fairly tight link between the stimulus, in this case the leopard, and giving a call. Although not all animals that see a leopard will give a call, so it's not completely reflexive. Mm-hmm. What seems to be lacking in these monkeys is the ability to attribute ignorance and mental states, as I said before, to their audience. So monkeys, and as far as we know, apes, don't really recognize when an individual is ignorant and needs to be informed, or already knowledgeable and perhaps doesn't need to be informed. Many animal species give alarm calls that function in a kind of altruistic way, in the sense that they alert group companions. And of course, remember that in many of these groups, groups are composed often of individuals who are quite closely related to each other. So individuals are helping their relatives when they give these alarm calls, as well as strangers.
Mm. Mark Hauser, why do you think that people wonder about this all the time? I certainly do. Why do you think animals have not evolved to have a language? What is standing in the way, for example, of a monkey developing its own language more fully? Is it the brain? Is it the genes? Is it not the right time? Is that what sets us apart from the other animals?
I guess at some level, of course, it has to be the brain, and then of course it has to be the genes that create the brain. But I guess if you're asking kind of how do we kind of make progress beyond this?
Yeah.
I think there you know, for me at least, in terms of, again, sort of thinking about the internal, sort of computational abilities of the mind, I think there are at least three critical pieces that animals lack. that basically make their systems of communication, though very rich and interesting and worthy of lots of studies, as all of us do, just different from what's going on when we communicate. And that is that I don't think they have the ability to create words the way we create words. They don't have the ability to string those words together to create longer sequences of utterances that have new meaning. And importantly, they don't have the capacity for vocal learning or vocal imitation, which is really fundamental to us building up this rich vocabulary of words that we have. So if we didn't have the ability to hear a word, in our case, for one time and say, okay, I'm going to call this thing over here a radiator, and now I point to it and show you to it, now you know what radiator means. I can repeat that exactly the way you said it, and that capacity allows us to build up a very, very rich lexicon. So those three pieces together, and there may be other things, I think really greatly limit the extent to which animals can do the translation of the rich experiences they have to telling somebody else. So in some sense, I agree and am very sympathetic to the kind of work that Barbara describes. I think the real puzzle, and I think Dorothy alluded to it earlier, is the fact that if these animals are having, let's say two animals are having a very rich social interaction, they're grooming each other, they're exchanging babies back and forth, if now one of those animals goes up and goes to somebody who was not a part of that, they have no mechanism to explain what just went on. And it's that kind of limitation that I think is really what makes the difference. And again, going back to the caller's question, this doesn't make it uninteresting. It's a difference, the same way that bats can echolocate and we can't. You just have species differences.
Barbara King, any reaction?
Well, I agree that if one ape is observing an interaction, that ape has no way to then turn to a social companion and explain things. I think that what's fascinating for me is taking what the apes can and cannot do and being able to plug that into a picture of understanding what happened during hominid evolution. To me, the real beauty of studying these creatures is that we can combine a qualitative and a quantitative study and really use it anthropologically to understand that this was a very gradual process of language evolution, that we humans have a long evolutionary history in which some of the components for language have been present for a very long time, and others are much newer. And that's the approach that I'm trying to take. I've been writing with the psychologist Stuart Shanker about these issues.
1-800-989-8255. Carolyn in Denver. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I just had a fun experience that I wanted to share kind of along those lines. We were at the, my family was at the Denver Zoo, and our zoo has just a beautiful exhibit for the gorillas. And it's got their big space where the gorillas all live together and a big panel of glass and these low steps that the visitors to the zoo sit on to watch the animals doing their thing. And so I was there with my family, and I was sitting down on the steps, and my little boy was about 1.5, just a little toddler. And we were kind of looking at the animals, and my husband was standing towards the back of the room reading, you know, the plaques and signs about the gorillas. And one of the female gorillas started to move forward towards the glass that was between us, and, you know, looking at something in her exhibit. And it scared my little boy, and he started to cry. Well, I just naturally reached out my arms to gather him into my lap. And the female became very concerned when she heard his crying. And she kind of came, you know, was looking and came forward. And we all thought that was kind of interesting. Well, then my husband turned around, and he walked forward towards my son and myself and was standing over us. And at that point, the big silverback, who we thought he was just minding his own business, eating leaves, kind of towards the back of his exhibit, he reared up and he raced towards the glass, and boom, he slammed it with his arm. And the whole thing, you know, vibrated and our heart rates jumped up. And it was, you know, it was very exciting. And the docent who was there said, well, look, you were doing gorilla things. You know, here was the female sitting on the steps. You know, I was down. I was sitting, you know, lower, and I was gathering this baby into my arms and so forth. And the male was very threatened by this other male, my husband, walking up to us. And so the silverback boomed on the glass. Well, you know, interestingly, my little boy was not at all afraid by that. He was thrilled. But we were all very clear you know, especially, I mean, we didn't even really need the docent to tell us what had happened.
Let me get a reaction. We're talking about gorillas this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Barbara, what do you think about that?
Well, I think I'd like to hire Carolyn. She's a great observer, so maybe I can get her number. But seriously, there are two points that leap out at me from this incident. One is that it goes to show that the gorillas are very capable of nuanced readings of another species, you know, for which I think is very important. Also, I think it does suggest, if in fact the female gorilla was showing